This is Generations. Welcome. Kevin Swanson with you today, and pride comes before a fall, and the fall has just begun. The latest Gallup poll just released this week finds 9% of U.S. adults identifying as sexually perverted, up from 3.7% in 2014. Now, let's go back into history. The first buggery law took effect in 1533. That's what they used to call homosexuality and other forms of perversion. And the first prosecution turned out to be the headmaster of Eton College, prosecuted in 1533. Nicholas Udall was a playwright, which no doubt kicked off the Shakespearean and Christopher Marlowe revival of theater and homosexuality in the homosexual sonnets in the 1590s. But over 300 years of UK history, there were only about 12 prosecutions recorded in England for this activity, which puts an incidence of homosexuality in England somewhere around 0.00012%, as compared to 9% today. The Great Awakening, the evangelical revivals of the 18th century, actually slowed down the onslaught of cultural and social depravity and decay, but the influence of Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill overcame the cultural opposition in the 1800s with a little help from the softening of the entire evangelical world on the subject of God's law in the 1800s. BTW, John Stuart Mill was Jeremy Bentham's godson. You can read all about it in my book, Apostate, The Men Who Destroyed the Christian West. If you want to understand how the revival of homosexuality and all that destroys human civilization occurred, it's in my book, Apostate. Well, today, 9% of U.S. adults identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's 18% of 20-somethings and about 31% of 20-something women, meaning that one out of every three young women you run into is out of the closet, self-defined as sexual perverted, or violating God's laws as recorded in Romans 1, 1 Corinthians 6, and Leviticus 18. Well, today, 2.4% of congressional members out in Washington are out of the closet, self-professed homosexuals. And according to news sources, 5% of the PMs of the British Parliament are out of the closet homosexuals as well. In 2014, 3.7% of Americans claimed sexual perversion for their identity. Well, today, that's 9%. Now, what makes up the difference? Why the almost threefold increase since 2014? That's the question. Okay, here it is. Are you ready for this? Widespread cultural acceptance of homosexuality and sexual perversion via media, theater, liberal arts, and Hollywood, coupled with a widespread social and academic acceptance on college campuses, coupled with civil acceptance by U.S. Supreme Court dictate. And don't forget, now we have the polyamory thing being advertised on Amazon, Netflix, etc., etc. So again, what makes up the difference? Obergefell makes up the difference. The one or two preachers out there who continued to stand on God's law in 2015 were despised, castigated, thrown out of every game. The mainstream media, though, were making it look cool. Fox News made it look cool with its complete endorsement of Bruce Jenner and drag since 2022. But now here is the big news from Gallup polls. Public support for homosexuality has dropped off from 71% to 65% in just the last 2 to 3 years. Most of that drop-off contributed by the Republican Party. Republican support of homosexuality has dropped from 55% to 37% in just the last 4 years. And independent voter support for sexual perversion dropped off from 74% to 64%, a 10% drop-off over the last 5 years. Now, how do we explain this sudden shift? Well, when a perversion squeezes its way out of the closet, or better put, when the nude emperor steps out of the closet, he will need an extremely well-produced propaganda campaign to prop up his little act. Any slight dissent must be shouted down by the media and utterly squelched by the political and business elite and sports elite, i.e. the NFL, MLB, and the NBA. That's why DEI. That's why the shutting down of free speech on college campuses. That's why Obergefell, all to defend a thin minority who want to flaunt their sexual perversions in public places and normalize it and reproduce their perversions by a sales pitch, one generation after the next. And they're somewhat successful at that with the Gen Z generation. So how do we explain the sudden shift? Three things. One, Americans don't like to be shoved around. At least some segment of Americans still don't like to be shoved around by the thought police, the speech police, the DEI police, and all the rest of them. That's number one. Number two, America is divided. And those dividing lines are becoming sharper and sharper. The radical left wrapped up the ethnic immigration thing with the homosexual thing as kind of a package deal, seeking special treatment for all of their favorite minorities. So when the right turned against the left on the ethnic immigration thing, at least the Trumpers were thinking, why not go up against the homosexual thing at the same time? It was a package deal. Remember that. The mainstream media has lost ground since the 1990s. This mind control maintained by the mainstream media is gone now. ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox News and CNN, they've lost control. Trust in media was 70% in 1970s, down to 53% in 1997. Now only 28%, a record low of Americans, per the 2025 survey from Pew Research. Today, Pew says 86% of U.S. adults get news at least sometimes from digital devices, while 64% get news from television at least sometimes. So only 7% say they often get news from printed newspapers or magazines. That's down from 67% in 1990. That's huge. This is what we call the Babel principle in action. Man centralizes power. Come on. Come on now. Let's build a city and a tower. And then God decentralizes it by the cacophony of opinions, languages, cultural views, and competing voices. He knocks down their little power system with his little pinky, and that's the end of it. All right, there's a third cause that I think is contributing something to this public shift on homosexuality, at least among the Republican Party. And I call it the Jehu man, the Trumpster, the bull in the china shop of the DEI. And one more thing, this is more fundamental. There is a God in the heavens, and he will raise up an occasional Jehu to take care of business with Ahab and his wife Jezebel. Here's how the story goes from 2 Kings 9, if you want to understand how God operates, at least with the northern tribes of Israel in the roughly 800 BC. Now, verse 30 of 2 Kings 9, when Jehu had come to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it, and she put paint on her eyes and adorned her head, and looked through a window. Then as Jehu entered at the gate, she said, "Is it peace, Zimri, murderer of your master?" And he looked up at the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" So two or three of the eunuchs looked out at him. Then he said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down, and some of her blood spattered on the wall and on the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. And when he had gone in, he ate and drank. And then he said, "Go now, see to this accursed woman and bury her, for she was a king's daughter." So they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. Therefore they came back and told him, and he said, "This is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, 'On the plot of ground at Jezreel, dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be as refuse on the surface of the field in the plot at Jezreel, so that they shall not say, here lies Jezebel.'" Okay, my friends, this sort of rebellion against God's law order never lasts very long. Society burns out, brimstone falls, the Jehus turn on the Ahabs and Jezebels, not to mention the massively powerful Western institutions that have turned into the strongest international Borg opposing God's institution of marriage and family that the world has seen to date. So let's not minimize any of this. Psalm 37 still applies, however. "Wait on the Lord and keep his way, and he shall exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, you shall see it. I have seen the wicked in great power, spreading himself like a native green tree. Yet he passed away, and behold, he was no more. Indeed, I sought him, but he could not be found." Well, today, Sam Rust joins me on Generations for this conversation. Talk about the shifting winds in the zeitgeist. Is it just a temporary gust blowing a different direction, or is this the end of the Pride Month phenomenon? Now, Sam Rust joins me on Generations, and Sam, it's good to have you back with us on this conversation. I mean, big things. Things are changing. Like, I have not seen things change this quickly in my life, you know, in terms of changing towards the better. Has this surprised you?
You know, I think, Kevin, one of the benefits of youth is maybe a little bit of unwarranted optimism. And so I just haven't seen as many storm clouds billow over the horizon. And so I was hopeful that we would end up here. It's been just hugely encouraging to see public sentiment and the way it's swung. over the last few years. It seems to be picking up momentum vis-a-vis the pride issue. I think people realize, I mean, and a lot of people, maybe if they have a little bit longer memory, they think back to the moral majority. And when gay marriage first started to be a thing, a lot of folks were out with the clarion call of, here's where we're going to end up. We're going to end up transing our kids. We're going to end up with weird polycules. And they got ridiculed by mainstream media. No, they're just two people that love each other. Well, we sped ran past all the things that were said in the 90s and early 2000s. And it turns out that God has bestowed a lot of common grace in this world. And though there's many, many unregenerate people, there's still God's law written in our hearts. There's still conscience, and there's still a restraint from the full force and effects of evil in its most depraved forms. And and this is an encouraging example of that in America today.
But we're going to get to how societies don't last very long when they give way to dissipation. I want to, you know, draw in Persia, Greece, Rome into that, because I do believe, yeah, without the common grace, without some kind of sanity returning to family structures, sexuality, etc., within our various civilizations, especially Western civilization, I just don't think we have a shot at surviving. If there's anything that history can teach us, it would be that. But let's look at the, you know, what's going on right now. I mean, here's a data point. Only 131 companies have submitted data to the HRC Corporate Equality Index this year, down from 377 last year. That's a huge fall off. That's like an 80% fall off in just a single year. And the HRC Corporate Equality Index, in case anybody wants to know, is really the DEI centerpiece of the corporate world. You know, this is the Fortune 500 organization that is you know, attempting to survey as many Fortune 500 companies as possible to encourage them to DEI policies. And what they're saying is companies aren't even submitting anything now. 131 out of 500 would put you at maybe 20%, 25% of companies are submitting data to the HRC organization. And that's down from, you know, 377 last year. That's, it looks to me like the corporate world is saying goodbye to DEI. That's what I'm seeing here, Sam.
And I think a lot of that is because there's people who have gotten into the fray in the investing world. Inspire Investing, a company that's based here in Idaho, has been in the vanguard of really standing up against a lot of these DEI mandates that run counter to long-standing SEC regulations about what companies exist to do. Companies exist to serve their shareholders in ways that you can actually measure, i.e. profitability. And the whole DEI structure was a way to kind of pivot away from objective measures of success and capture the business world for ideology and ideological purposes. And turns out they didn't push far enough. They didn't get all the laws changed fast enough. And so folks like Inspire have had tremendous success in pushing back on Costco. At one point, Costco was donating to pride parades and different drag shows. And after Inspire got involved, this was back in 2022, they pulled back from that and made it a new corporate policy that Costco was no longer going to participate in those kind of events. And then we have, of course, the whole Bud Light, Dylan Mulvaney situation from a couple of years ago. There's just been more and more of these people standing up saying, this isn't right. This is ridiculous. And corporations are fundamentally centered still around their profitability, and it's being impacted.
It was a shock to me that the national sports programs would bend over backwards and make their proper prostrations to the gods of the market, you know, the gods of homosexuality over the last number of years. The NFL, Major League Baseball, the basketball league. It just, was that a shock to you that, you know, these manly sports programs that I think more or less appeal to the American male would be so given towards endorsing homosexuality and participating in this Pride Month thing? Was it a gun to the head? Was it either you do this or we're going to shame you? Or what was it that got all of these major league, you know, sports programs to do this?
I think it was the effects of the managerial class, right? And so, you know, Christianity, there's hierarchy built into Christianity. We see that in God's relationship to us. We even see that within the Trinity. We certainly see that in the created order, but corporations have gone more and more down this managerial pathway, and that particular set of organizations are ripe for takeover by this leftist secular humanist ideology. And I think you saw the corporate offices of these sports all be staffed with a lot of folks that grew up in the Whartons and the Harvards and thought that this was the pathway to success. I think you have some ideological crusaders who saw this as a pathway and were intent on using it for their own ends. And then you have a lot of people that just kind of went along and I guess diversity really is our strength, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All the talking points that have been shoved in our faces for the last 20, 30 years and have picked up steam in the late 20 teens. And you have these corporate entities like the NFL, like the MLB, that are just, they're responding to culture and they're inside of a bubble. They kind of lost sight of their customers. And it maybe did surprise me a little bit how much they lost sight of their customers, but they weren't punished immediately for going down that pathway. It's taking a buildup of pressure. And we're seeing that even in social media engagement. I ran a quick study on MLB's Pride announcement. They did one this year again in on X. And one of the things about X as a social media platform is you want to look at the ratio of likes to whatever post it is versus comments. And the lower that ratio is, the more comments you have, it usually shows that it's more of a controversial issue because X is kind of a social media platform of bubbles. Well, in normal cases, when you get wide distribution on a post, you're going to have maybe 10% of your likes will convert to comments. This year, it's like 35%. There was 30,000 likes, give or take, and about 13,000 comments, which just shows a firestorm of reaction from across the space and people engaging in a really negative way. And that trend has been building over the last couple of years just on the one social media platform that I looked at.
Yeah, and the NFL organization this year, apparently first time they refused to recognize Pride Month as of June 1st and June 2nd. So they didn't, you know, throw out their great, you know, rainbow thing and say how much we, you know, support homosexuality, the LGBTQ thing. And as of this update, these teams have not yet published Pride Month messaging on their social media accounts. The Dallas Cowboys, New Orleans Saints, Cincinnati Bengals, Cleveland Browns, Kansas City Chiefs, Las Vegas Raiders, New York Jets, Pittsburgh Steelers, and Tennessee Titans. I'm guessing that's about a third of the teams. So it does appear to be, you know, backing away from supporting this this abomination that that became so popular. Now, I think it was Obergefell probably more than anything else that pretty much tripled the support for homosexuality and the participation in homosexuality in America. I think my numbers I gave on the front end was 3.5 up to 9% between 2014 and 2026 as to those who profess themselves to be, you know, embracing the lifestyle of sexual abominations. Here's one more thing I want to throw out, though, right now, because I think this is interesting. I want your take on this. I did a program on this maybe 2 weeks ago where I looked at the East-West worldview battle. Now, I look at the battle lines right now. If you think about the battle lines, what are the battle lines? I mean, the real battle lines where wars are happening in the world today. Where are they? Well, you've got the battle line in Ukraine. You've got Israel. You've got Taiwan. So those are the three battle lines. Now, Israel is celebrating Pride Month big time, probably more so than it ever has right now this year. Ukraine's Supreme Court endorsed homosexual marriage for the first time, I'm going to say, 3 months ago. Now, granted, apparently the legislature of Ukraine is calling that to question. But whatever the case is, homosexual marriage has been approved in Ukraine as of this year. And you can bet Russia's not doing that. And then you got Taiwan approving of homosexual marriage in 2019. So here we got three of the most, you know, critical, I would say, dividing lines between East and West, literally being fought out in the geopolitical wars of the day, Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan, and they're tipping towards the embracing of homosexuality. I think that's interesting. I think that's really interesting. In other words, see, I believe that there's a God in the heavens, you know, who's the great judge over all things, the arbiter of all things. And this kind of thing, this kind of embracing of the Sodom worldview is nothing that you know, renders the approval of the Most High.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things at play. I do think it's really interesting that where there's conflict right now, we have this significant trend towards degeneracy. I think a lot of that traces back to USAID, which is a massive government program, a slush fund of between 60 and 80, maybe as much as 100 billion a year. We still don't really know the full extent of USAID, but it was a program born out of the OSS, and then later the CIA, that was administered through the State Department and was sending money around the world. I mean, you think of any crazy governmental headline, the US is supporting underwater basket weaving courses at some university in South Africa, USAID. But a lot of the degeneracy was being exported by that as well. And I think what we saw was a class of global elite, global secularists, to identify them by their philosophical leanings, that were seeking to use our tax dollars to further their globalist agenda. And we see that in Ukraine, particularly, where Zelensky is nothing but a pawn of the European and really leftist elite from around the world. So it really goes hand in hand. I mean, we were spreading the gospel of homosexuality. There was pride flags outside of embassies. But it is very interesting that, so USAID gets cut off by Elon Musk, Donald Trump, and the Doge effort last March, was the kind of the death knell, so March of 2025. Mm-hmm. Since then, there's been seven different elections held across Southern and Central South America and Central America, and all of them, without exception, have gone to right-wing candidates. Colombia being the latest example, there's a runoff slated for, I think, the middle of July, but the right-wing candidate emerged victorious and almost won outright with a 51% majority in elections held late last week. We're seeing examples, pride is on the outs in America. And some of that is organic, and we've talked about some of those reasons. But I really do believe that so much of what we were seeing at pride parades around our country were our own tax dollars being funneled back in through NGOs, through USAID, and ginning up this activity, ginning up popular support that really wasn't authentic. And I hope we're not snapping back to some baseline of 1985. I want us to go back even further than that. I want us to go forward and be more sanctified as a nation than we have been ever. But I think some of what we might be seeing is just the thumb has come off of the scale. We're not seeing money flowing the same way that it has over the last 50, 60 years into these left-wing causes.
Do you think that some of our conservatives today understand that you cannot survive as a society if you give way to this kind of sexual perversion and just the dissipation, the moral dissipation that, you know, we saw in the breakdown of Persia, Greece, and Rome in the ancient days? I guess some people think that the gods of the Coptic beheadings will not return with slaughter and terror, as Kipling would put it. But, you know, hey, the same principles apply today as they did back then. It's just, I guess we think we have better technology, better science, and better, you know, economy today. And so we can somehow support our dissipation longer and not worry about having to pay the piper. But eventually, you know, we're going to have to pay the piper. And these civilizations are not going to survive if they give way to the destruction of the family, the breakdown of sexuality. I think that's a given. But do our conservative leaders understand this principle, do you think?
I don't think so, at least not at a heart level. And a very recent example, just in the last 48 hours, you had Congressman Andy Ogles, I think he's out of Nebraska, that came out very strong against Pride Month and talking about the nuclear family and our mm-hmm. Christian values and our Christian heritage and how that's antithetical to homosexuality. And then you had Ted Cruz come out yesterday, ostensibly conservative senator from Texas, saying, well, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. What two consenting adults do in a room by themselves is really none of our business as a society. But interestingly enough, Ted Cruz has a daughter who's a lesbian.
Yeah,
and I think
maybe that softened him a bit. Yeah, could have softened him a bit.
That has a massive impact, and I think it's really important that we understand. You look at Rome. You mentioned Rome earlier, Kevin. Rome was decadent, debauched. when Christ was around.
Mm-hmm.
But that society continued on for a long time.
Sure.
The Greeks
sure.
Continued on for quite a ways as mm-hmm. well. Why are we accelerating? And I think it really is technology and social media. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing this specifically with the transing issues. It's easiest to call it out there, where it really was a social contagion. It was a social phenomenon that as soon as Musk bought Twitter, now known as X, and allowed there to be a true town hall online where ideas could be freely exchanged and there, you didn't have the managerial class putting their thumb on the scales yet again, we saw it maps exactly. Public sentiment started to trend the other way on the trans issue. And the same thing is happening with homosexuality, I believe. But we have a whole generation of kids, unfortunately, not the entire generation, but a whole generation was exposed to the zenith of that ideology, and families are impacted. I know a lot of, or I should say maybe half a dozen or so families that come to mind that were very influential in politics, whether it was in California or Colorado or Utah, on the Republican side, and then had a child end up diving into homosexuality in one form or another. And then all of a sudden, they go quiet on the issue and they want to become the party of, well, let's make sure that we lower our taxes. Mm-hmm. Let's do the fiscally conservative things. But social conservatism is backwater. I think the moment for that is past. I think momentum is on the social issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people care about. Their lives are being impacted by these social issues. When you have people pretending to be dogs in public and demanding that you feed them to-go meals like a dog, like, that is obviously impacting our quality of life. Spencer Pratt in LA is running his whole campaign on, let's get the drug addicted people off the streets and keep them from dying right in front of schools. Like, this matters to people in a really tangible way, and they want to put the toothpaste back in the tube. We can't do that. The only way forward is through the cross.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about, you know, salvaging a civilization as we wrap this thing up, but I want to read just a segment from Preparing the World for Jesus, where, you know, we deal with a lot of these old empires and bring out the stories, because we think that if our young people are educated well enough in some of these areas and they understand history, then perhaps, just perhaps, they might be the salt to preserve a civilization in the next generation. That's really a big reason for the curriculum that we throw out there. But here's a comment on I think this is on Persia. Yeah, this is Persia. Preparing the World for Jesus would have been around the time of Alexander the Great and, you know, his conquest over Persia in what was at 330 BC. The constituent hardiness for which the mountain tribes of the Medes and Persians were known did not continue for long after they had collected for themselves the expansive wealth and power of a great empire. Despite having achieved the status of the greatest empire ever, the temptation to drunkenness, sexual dissipation, and gluttony was just too much for them. While the Persians were known for eating just one meal a day, this meal eventually extended from noon until bedtime. I'm serious. This is what Herodotus would say. The aristocracy stuffed themselves with 1,000 delicacies. Cadres of chefs invented thousands of new sauces and desserts. The Greek historian Herodotus reports that the Persians had given way to the voluptuousness and that they had, quote, learnt from the Greeks the practice of homosexuality. This would prove to be their undoing. The Persian kings multiplied wives and concubines to themselves. Make no mistake, this is an outright rejection of the wisdom of prophets in Deuteronomy. What my son of my womb, what son of my vows, do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. Artaxerxes I produced one legitimate son and at least 18 sons from his concubines. 60 years later, Artaxerxes II claimed 3 legitimate sons and 150 by concubines. Murder ruled the day as the governance unraveled. The complex and ever-destructive web of intrigue and treachery present in the Persian court is illustrated by a list that I give in the book. To finish off the empire, sexual corruption literally corrupted all aspects of society, including the state. A certain homosexual, Bagogas the Younger, is remembered for inspiring high levels of moral chaos in the Persian court and the final demise of the state. He murdered Artaxerxes III, most of his family, and then handed the scepter over to a friend named Darius III, who officiated the end of it. As reported by historian Quintus Curtius, Darius rode into battle to meet Alexander the Great, hauling with him an entire procession of mother, wife, children, governess, and 365 concubines, also regally dressed and adorned. Much of the entourage were slaughtered, including 329 concubines who were playing musical instruments along the way. At the Battle of Issus in 333, the Macedonians under Alexander lost just 450 men to the Persian casualties of 40,000. Darius abandoned his family in the field, ran for his life. 2 years later, he returned with 100,000 troops against Alexander's 50,000. Alexander defeated Darius again. Subsequently, Darius was killed by a relative, and thus the mighty Achaemenid empire had come to an end. The judgment of God upon Persia was inescapable. Okay, so that's just the story of Persia and the end of Persia. Rome sort of went out with a gasp towards the end. But, you know, if you read City of God, you're going to discover that, you know, Rome fell because of its immoralities. And eventually, you know, the hammer fell on Rome. Now, could that happen in this post-Christian age in the Western world? I think it could. But nevertheless, you know, there's still us left, right? There's Christians, the salt of the earth. Now it's time for us to rebuild a civilization. Either we can rebuild today, or we can start rebuilding 38 years from now, or 147 years from now. But if Christ tarries, Sam, we got to keep building.
And we have examples in our heritage, Kevin. One would be King Alfred.
Yes.
Many people don't realize that England was captured for Christ essentially twice. Once in the 400 and 500s, and then there was decadence, and they fell, and the Danes came, and it was weak and fractured. And then Alfred brought back centrality of Christ, brought back the people, united them against the Danes, and led to another rise in English culture that we trace so much of our heritage back to today. The book White Horse King by Ben Merkel is an excellent retelling of that from a Christian perspective. I highly recommend that.
Yeah, good book, good book. And don't forget Athelstan, the first king of England, Alfred's grandson, very important person.
Yeah. Carried on that legacy really well. Mm-hmm. Even the Spanish Reconquista, you know, the Spaniards never quite were pushed entirely out of the Andalusian Peninsula. There was still a remnant in the north area, right up by the border of France and the Pyrenees. And then they were able to push out the Moors and win back Spain. Yes, it took 600-700 years, but they were never completely vanquished. And so a lot of people would have you have us believe that there is no redemption, that there is no path, that we must be wiped off the face of the earth, the slate must be cleaned, and then there can be something new that arises. That doesn't have to be. That's not the inevitability of history. Now, God has designed the world in such a way that those who deviate from a proper anthropology will receive their just reward. And we definitely have sowed a lot of seeds that need to be pulled up, dried out, tossed into the fire, and burned. But as you said, there's a remnant, and God was willing to spare Sodom if 10 mm-hmm. righteous had been found.
That's right. That's right.
That's not a guarantee that America will be spared. And quite frankly, we're experiencing the bitter fruit of having those who are unrighteous reign over us. Mm-hmm. And the impacts of those rulers are felt in our day-to-day lives, in some areas of our country more than others. But that should just stiffen our backbones. It should encourage us to get on our knees and then into action. God wants us to be a people that pursues him first and foremost. We know that all power has been given to Christ. Let's make him known in our lives, in our families, in our churches, in our communities. And that's how we can follow Alfred and Athelstan and what they accomplished.
That's right. Really, really exciting stuff. In fact, you know, we deal with a lot of that in Epoch, The Rise and Fall of the West. Athelstan's huge in terms of the development of a Christian civilization in the Western world. Good insights today from Sam Rust. I want to recommend to our listening audience Preparing the World for Jesus and then Taking the World for Jesus. It's really our ninth grade history, but it's good for anybody. If you want to really get the perspective of what Jesus has done and how he turned on the lights and big things have happened over the last 2,000 years of Jesus's involvement, and to give us a little bit of inspiration as to what will happen next in the next chapter, because believe it or not, guys, we are the next chapter. So keep that in mind. And overall, it's an unstoppable, optimistic story of history, his story, God's story, and you'll get it with Preparing the World for Jesus and Taking the World for Jesus. It's a different angle. It's a biased angle. It's a Jesus bias. And by the way, what Jesus has done in history can never be undone. Jesus has changed the world, and it will never be the same because of the impact that Jesus and his people have made upon the world, the whole world, over the last 2,000 years. All right. Well, that's it for this edition of the program. Thanks, Sam. Appreciate you joining us on this edition.
Thank you, Kevin.
And friends, please join us again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation. This has been a production of the Generations Media Network. For more information, go to generations.org/media.